In the annals of Middle-earth, it is well known that Isildur, High King of Arnor and Gondor, failed to destroy the One Ring when he had the chance, instead preserving it as a keepsake and an heirloom. Yet how did he come to lose the ring? What evil circumstances conspired against him? Join us as we explore the disaster of the Gladden Fields. The Tolkien Road, Episode 214, Unfinished Tales, The Disaster of the Gladden Fields, Part 1. Hello everyone, welcome to The Tolkien Road, Episode 214. Greta,
hey.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Good.
Doing well.
Awesome.
Weather's starting to get right about where I like it outside. Don't even have to use the AC here in the studio on a day such as today, so this is right in my cruising zone.
Cruising zone.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little chilly for me.
Yeah.
But I'm glad you're happy.
Good.
Yeah.
Well,
I do like fall. I do.
Yeah.
I just, you know, if it were sunny, I think I'd like it better.
Yeah.
It's the overcast gloominess I don't like.
Mm.
I don't mind the cold or the chilly or the beautiful trees. The trees are amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. But it's just the cold damp I don't like.
I like the overcast gloominess.
I know you do.
Yeah.
I know. It's just, I like it now and then. Now and
mm-hmm.
then. I'm just glad I spent a lot of time outside yesterday because I'm not going to be outside today.
Well,
that's
okay.
So.
Well, hey, everybody. So on this episode, we are beginning a two-part look at the disaster of the Gladden Fields from Unfinished Tales. Before we get started, we'd like to give a shout-out to our patrons. Special thanks to this episode's executive producer, Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien. Thank you so much, Caitlin.
Yes, thank you, Caitlin.
Also, a shout-out to our newest patron, Riff M.
Riff?
Yeah.
Cool name.
Very cool.
Yeah. Thank you, Riff.
That's a cooler name than John, I'll tell you that. Thanks, Mom. Thanks,
for
Dad.
Sure.
And, hey, you too can support us on Patreon if you don't already. So, why aren't you doing it yet? Head on over to patreon.com/Tolkien Road. Becoming a patron lets you support the show in a tangible way and lands you some awesome perks like early access to new episodes and more. So.
Yeah.
I don't see why people wouldn't become patrons.
Me neither.
Right.
It's beyond my scope of understanding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can feel people all over the earth right now rushing to their computers and being like, why am I not a patron yet? What the bleep?
Yeah.
Had to bleep. That was a professional bleep. Had to bleep that because it's a...
We've got to keep our rating in check.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what our rating is.
All right. It's a clean rating.
Clean.
Yes. We're family friendly here.
All righty.
Even if the last episode did cover the potential sexiness of Latron Prime.
Yeah, I was wondering if that was going to affect our rating at
all.
Well,
I feel like we kept it, you know, we didn't get all, we weren't like explicit talking about it in explicit ways.
No, we weren't.
So.
We weren't. But maybe a disclaimer would be good. So, you know. Parents don't put it on in the car while they're driving with
their
children.
I called the episode Latron Prime the sexy age. So,
oh, okay. But maybe that's enough of a disclaimer in and of itself.
I thought to myself, this could get really dangerous. Who knows what people are going to find me and what they're going to expect from this episode with that kind of title.
And yet you named it that anyway.
It seemed appropriate.
Okay.
What can I say?
Okay.
It seemed appropriate.
At the time.
Yeah. So, hey, also you can leave a tip on an individual episode. If you just think an individual episode is just so darn special, head on over to TolkienRoad.com, find the post for that episode, and click the leave a tip button, the blue leave a tip button, and we'll get that tip. So.
Yeah. That's a cool feature.
We'd appreciate it if you did that.
Every little bit.
Every little bit helps to support the show and make it better and better and better.
Yep, so, yep. All the things.
Yeah. So, also, subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes and other podcasting platforms. Please leave us a 5-star rating and say some nice things about us. If we like what you say, then we'll probably read your comment on an episode. So you get to hear your own words read on the episode.
I was trying to think about what else you could possibly say.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's what I was expecting.
Well, I knew what I was going to say. I was just searching for the words.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, leaving 5 stars in a review helps get the word out about us. So please, if nothing else, head on over and leave us 5 stars and tell the world what you love about the Tolkien Road. No real Tolkien news this week. So, you know, I'm guessing there's a mad scramble in the Latron Prime production team to
after our episode,
completely scrap everything and start afresh.
Mm-hmm.
Fire all of the nude actors.
Right.
Right. Hopefully they give them their clothes back first, but go ahead and fire all those nude actors. So I'm sure they're...
I'm sure they're busy.
Yeah.
So they haven't had time to put any news out.
They got to completely replan and reshoot the whole first couple
episodes.
You know?
Rewrite the script.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot. Yeah. It's a lot. So we're going to cut them some slack for the next couple weeks at least.
Maybe 1 week. You got another week. And then we want to hear some news.
I think that's fair. Yeah. So at that point, it would have been 2 whole weeks, I think.
Boom.
Yeah.
Okay, correspondents, stick around to the end of the episode. Greta, are you ready to tackle the disaster of the Gladden Fields?
You know I am.
All right. In a tackling mood, are you?
You know it.
This account of the disaster of the Gladden Fields is found in Unfinished Tales, Part 3. It is the story of how the One Ring came to rest in a marshy vale between Mirkwood and the Misty Mountains and remained out of sight and out of mind for almost 2,500 years until it was discovered by the Stor Dagil and stolen from him by his cousin Smeagol.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
So that's what this episode's about. This chapter is really, like a lot of things in Unfinished Tales and in the history of Middle Earth, you kind of get the main thing of what we have from what Tolkien wrote. And then you get a lot of notes and editorial comments by Christopher. And this chapter is no different in that regard. So what we're going to do on this episode is we're going to look at the main text. And then on the next episode, we'll go into all the detail on some of the really interesting notes that he included after the main body of the tale. But this week, we're just going to talk about the main narrative that Tolkien constructed to talk about the disaster of the Gladden Fields.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
I thought that this account was initially how Isildur came to get the ring.
Nope.
So I was a little confused for like a paragraph.
No, this is after he gets the ring, right?
I realized that eventually. But I thought maybe it'd be helpful to clarify for our listeners, but you already did that. Because you mentioned it's how the ring becomes lost, not how it is found.
This is true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
An important distinction.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, you're right. So, this is not about... It begins with Isildur already having the ring in his possession.
Right.
Right? So, and I'm going to read the intro. If you go to the intro in Unfinished Tales, there's... Christopher says some things about each of the chapters in the book. It's actually pretty short, but I figure it's appropriate to read it beforehand. He says, "This is a late narrative, by which I mean no more, in the absence of any indication of precise date, than that it belongs to the final period of my father's writing on Middle-earth, together with Cirion and Eorl, the battles of the fords of Isen, the Druidine, and the philological essays excerpted in the history of Galadriel and Celeborn, rather than to the time of the publication of The Lord of the Rings and the years following it. There are two versions, a rough typescript of the whole, clearly the first stage of composition, and a good typescript incorporating many changes that breaks off at the point where Elendor urged Isildur to flee. The editorial hand has here had little to do." So basically Christopher is saying that there's really not a whole lot that he had to do to make this ready for publication based on what his father wrote. So what that tells us is that we're getting more or less what J.R.R. Tolkien himself said.
What he put to paper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Cool.
All right. So, you know, Greta, before we dive into the text, what were your what was your impression of this other than being surprised that it was about after he has the ring?
I guess I was surprised that there was still evil around.
Yeah.
Because I thought that Sauron. I still can't keep them straight. I thought he was dead and had been vanquished. And I thought, well, I just assumed that with him, all the evil forces would have been vanquished as well.
Yeah.
So I didn't understand why all of a sudden there were orcs around again.
Right.
So that was a little surprising to me.
No, that's a good point. That is a really good point. You would think that with Sauron vanquished like he was, that that all the evil forces would have been vanquished as well, and it would have been like this, you know, era of peace.
Right. Yeah.
But of course, he wasn't vanquished in full because the ring still existed.
The ring still existed.
Because Isildur failed to destroy the ring, right, when he had the chance.
Yes. Okay.
So that's the big problem. But of course, this starts a little later. So we find out in the first paragraph that Isildur becomes king of Arnor and is a man of great pride and vigor. Yeah. So Isildur, as we've seen, you know, we've kind of gotten more familiar with Isildur over the last, you know, several episodes, because he does play a role at the end of the Second Age, even before the infamous, you know, failure to destroy the One Ring, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's actually seems like a very heroic man,
yeah,
right? He is, do you remember like the key heroic thing he did when Numenor was still around?
Tree.
He saved Nimloth, right? Yeah. Or I'm sorry, he saved the fruit of Nimloth, which then became the White Tree of Gondor,
right?
So yeah, you know, so yeah, he did so at great peril, right?
Right.
He almost died in the process, right?
Yeah.
So Isildur, we all kind of know him in general as the guy who thanks a lot for not destroying the One Ring, but the reality is that he's a mixed bag, right? He was very heroic, and he did some very heroic deeds. Who knows all of the things that he might have done in the war of the last alliance of men and elves, right? So, you know, he's a mixture of good and bad, most.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
Like most
pretty
men.
Much the human race in general.
Exactly.
Yes.
But it says in particular that he's a man of great pride and vigor. Okay.
Mm,
so
yeah.
He remained for a year in Gondor, restoring its order and defining its bounds. But the greater part of the army of Arnor returned to Eriador by the Numenorean road from the fords of Isen to Fornost. All right. So just a little, I know you guys can't see this map, but I'm going to try my best to describe it for you, because I think the map is a little helpful in setting the stage here. So if you're looking at a map of Middle Earth, just basically like the one that's in the back of Lord of the Rings, then the map that they refer to there, the Numenorean road from the fords of Isen to Fornost, right? So you go and you look between the southern tip of the Misty Mountains and then the northern tip of, I believe it's the White Mountains, the little fork that forks off up towards the Misty Mountains there. And there's that little gap of, I think it's, mm-hmm. I think it's referred to as the Gap of Rohan. It's also referred to as the Fords of Isen, but there's a road that goes all the way up from there all the way up to Fornost, which is about right here in the middle of Eriador. And, you know, from there, it's a much easier road up to travel up to Arnor. But it, you know, it's looking on a big map like this, it can seem deceptive how long a journey that would be, right? So mm-hmm. it's a pretty long journey. But anyway, there was a road, at least in ancient times. I'm not sure about the status of it at the end of the Third Age, but there was a road that existed to connect Gondor and Arnor, basically.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. Good.
So,
I mean, they're far. They're far apart.
They are very far apart.
Yeah.
All right. So when he wishes to return to Imladris first before returning to Arnor. Do you remember why that is?
Because his wife and kid are there.
That's right. Yeah. His wife and his youngest son are there.
Yeah.
Right. We're going to learn more about all of his sons in this chapter, but his youngest son is, of course, I believe Valandil, and let me double check that. Yeah, Valandil. And Valandil is, of course, the one from whom Aragorn is descended,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So
where is Imladris?
Imladris.
Imladris. Where
well,
is it
Imladris you would know by a different name.
Or would I?
Yeah.
What is it?
It's Rivendell.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he...
You're like, why can't he just call it Rivendell?
Oh,
yeah,
because it's Tolkien.
Yeah, so Imladris, of course, is on the western slope, western edge of the Misty Mountains, to the east.
It's kind of on his way
of
to Arnor,
Weathertop,
right?
Well, we're going to get back to that. We're going to come back to that. But
okay,
let's look at what the text has to say.
Okay, let's
so
do that.
He's got to return to Imladris first. All right, so And he had, and it says he had an urgent need for the Council of Elrond. What do you think the reason for that is?
To tell them about. No, wait, I don't know.
The One Ring, right? You know, to
he
hasn't to get
told
his,
them yet.
To get his counsel. I'm not sure if he told him at this point or not, but to get his counsel at least on what to do with the One Ring, right?
Okay.
Yeah. So
seems like that's something he should have done ASAP.
Well. So the reason he ends up going the way he does, but he doesn't go the road of Numenor. That's the point, right? He instead of going that road of Numenor, he decides to go north from Asgiliath, and basically go like travel the eastern side of the Anduin,
by
right?
Mirkwood.
By Mirkwood, which at that time was, you know, was Greenwood, right? Greenwood the Great.
Okay.
So he basically decides he's going to travel up the eastern bank of the Anduin between Anduin and Mirkwood and Greenwood. And then he's going to cut over and cross the Misty Mountains into Rivendell. And it turns out that is actually a quicker way for him to go if he's going to stop at Imladris.
Yeah.
Right. In Rivendell. So
plus he didn't have any horses.
They didn't. Right.
So they were saying it was also faster to go this way because they were going to be on foot.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So it was a long journey, but it was shorter than the alternative. And the expected time from Asgiliath to Imladris is 40 days, right? So it's about a 40-day journey they expect on foot with all the company of men that he's keeping. So in the second year of the Third Age, he set forth from Asgiliath. Early, expecting to reach Imladris in 40 days, is what it says.
Okay, I'm just clarification question here.
Mm-hmm.
Why is he in Asgiliath to start with?
Well, Asgiliath would have been the capital of Gondor at that point, right? So,
and that's where he was living before he became king of Arnor.
I guess so. Yeah, I'd have to go back and look at that. Okay. So,
it's not a big deal. I was just wondering.
Let's see what. What was he before he became king of Arnor? Because he basically becomes the High King of Numenor. He becomes the High King of Gondor and Arnor. So Isildur and his brother Anarion jointly ruled Gondor in the south while their father dwelt in the north. Then Elendil, their father, dies in the last alliance of Men and Elves, as does Anarion. So Isildur becomes the High King of Gondor and Arnor, but he puts Meneldil, who is Anarion's son, in charge of Gondor when he leaves. So it's kind of like Arnor is basically where is supposed to be the seat of the Lost Realms, right? It's supposed to be, you know, you can think of Arnor and Gondor as different realms, but really they're united, right? They're a united realm and they have one king, and that's the High King.
Okay.
So then, there's like a king of Gondor, but he's kind of, you know, below the High King of Arnor and Gondor.
Okay. So he was in Gondor.
Yeah.
Because
he just stayed there after the end of the last alliance of Men and Elves.
I see. Okay.
He had just been there. Yeah.
Got it.
He was trying to put everything in order in Gondor. Obviously it had been a big war and, you know, there was lots of danger and disorder, and you know that's what they say in the first paragraph, right? He remained for a year in Gondor, restoring its order and defining its bounds.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, good question.
Yeah.
He sets out with his three eldest sons. Mm. All right, so let's go over his three eldest sons. All right, so we already mentioned Valandil, who is his youngest son. His three older sons are Elendur, Aratan, and Kirion. Right.
Yep.
So. Those are the three who are with him, and they are grown. They fought in the last alliance of Men and Elves. So, and then Valandil is just a boy, I believe, at this time.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Cool.
And then, so they set out on this 40-day journey from Asgiliath to Imladris, and then 20 days in, a storm blows up from the east. The rain becomes so bad that they have to turn from the Anduin and closer to Greenwood. Right, so they are on the eastern bank. So they have to perilously move away from close to the river where you can imagine it's probably more open and everything like that, right? There's, mm-hmm. you know, less risk of something attacking you from the woods, and they have to actually move closer to the woods, right?
Okay. To get out of the worst of the storm.
In order to get out of the worst of the storm. Okay. So, yeah, you know, the storm's blowing up from the east. I feel like there's a couple of different times that that happens, you know, in the legends of, in the legendarium, this bad weather coming in from the east, and you always wonder, like, you know, is Sauron behind that in some way, right?
I mean, how could he not be?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's not necessarily that he is, but...
No, I guess that's true. I mean, storms can arise naturally. That's true. Mm-hmm. But just the timing of it all seems rather convenient.
Yeah. Well, as we'll see, it maybe is. Or maybe it's just the, you know... And one of the themes, I think, of this work is the possibility that there's kind of the hidden mysterious will of Sauron still at work and all mm-hmm. in all of these things, right? That
because
even though Sauron
destroyed.
As a physical presence is vanquished, the ring being there, mm-hmm. right? It's almost like
it's almost like it's his soul.
Yeah.
Like it's a tesseract of some sort.
Yeah, and it just gives off bad luck vibes for whoever has it, right?
Yes.
Yeah. It's trying to get out of destroy you, get out of your hands, and into, you know, somehow find its way back into Sauron's hands. So, one thing I wanted to note was that it mentions Amon Lonk here, and Amon Lonk was the will be the future site of Dol Guldur, right? So, and this is mentioned when it brings up the rain. It says the rain lasted for 4 days. So when they came to the entrance of the Vales between Lorien and Amon Lonk, Isildur turned away from the Anduin, swollen with swift river, and went up the steep slopes on its eastern side to gain the ancient paths of the Sylvan Elves that ran near the eaves of the forest. Right? So really where they are, if you can look on your map, if you just find Dol Guldur and you find Lorien, you see how those are like east, that's like on a, they lie on an east-west axis with each other right there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, and then you have the Anduin River right here, which is much closer to Lorien. So basically you can think they were close to Lorien and then they had to move closer to Dol Guldur, right? Mm-hmm. And at this time, Dol Guldur is not Dol Guldur, it's just Amon Lonk. But it's interesting that that place that eventually becomes an important seat of power for Sauron mm-hmm. seems to play into the story here as well.
Yeah, that is interesting.
So, then we have that 30 days in, things are starting to look better. So they're 30 days into this potentially 40-day journey. We can imagine that they're probably further north from where they are. They're probably drawing near to this spot right here that says the Gladden Fields, right? Mm. Yeah, they're probably getting up closer to this region right here. All right, which, you know, you get up. They're not too far from where they might want to cross over towards Rivendell, right?
Yeah.
Kind of, you know. Northwest Gladden Fields mm-hmm. is kind of, it's like, you know, northwest shot to Rivendell right there, but maybe they're not ready to cross the Anduin yet and you know, and make their journey up the Misty Mountains, so they're still on the east bank. And with that, they start to hear the sound of orcs. In fact, they hear so many orcs they think they're 10 times outnumbered, and they form defensive ranks. It actually goes into some detail on like some of the different rank tactics that the Numenoreans may have employed. I thought that was kind of interesting. It talked about a shield wall of two serried ranks. So I'm guessing like serried, meaning like kind of like a serrated edge, right? Where it's kind of got the teeth.
Yeah.
So, you know, that can be bend back and forth at either end if outflanked and until it became a closed ring. It even said he would have thought of charging these orcs and just trying to break through any lines they had, but it wasn't really a good spot they were in to do so.
Right, because they were like in a valley. I mean, they were kind of in a spot that gave the orcs an advantage.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, at this point, Isildur starts to show the signs of the ring, right? He starts to think, the will of Sauron, right? The vengeance of Sauron is coming. All right. So it's almost like this is something that's haunting him this whole time. He says to Elendur, "The vengeance of Sauron lives on, though he may be dead. There is cunning and design here. We have no hope of help. Moria and Lorien are now far behind, and Thranduil 4 days march ahead. And we bear burdens of worth beyond all reckoning," said Elendur, for he was in his father's confidence, right? So Elendur is the one who says that last line, "And we bear burdens of worth beyond all reckoning. Everything before was Isildur." So they'll never learn how to edit dialogue properly. how to format dialogue properly so you don't automatically start thinking that somebody else says something, or that the same person is saying that something somebody else is saying. Yeah.
Just trying to keep you on your toes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so this, you know, we have this dialogue between Isildur and Elendur, and then Isildur commands Otar to take his stuff, right, and flee, right? So Otar is his
esquire.
His esquire. Yeah. You want to go ahead and read that paragraph there? The orcs were now drawing near.
The orcs were now drawing near. Isildur turned to his esquire, Otar. He said, I give this now into your keeping. And he delivered to him the great sheath and the shards of Narsil, Elendil's sword. Save it from capture by all means that you can find, and at all costs, even at the cost of being held a coward who deserted me. Take your companion with you and flee. Go, I command you. Then Otar knelt and kissed his hand, and the two young men fled down into the dark valley.
Yeah.
So he's taking a sword. Elendil's sword.
Narsil, right? The shards of Narsil, right?
Okay.
Yeah, and of course it's not the full sword, it's the shards of it, right?
Right. Yes.
That because Sauron had the sword had been basically broken into a bunch of pieces in the battle with Sauron. But he takes the sheath and then the shards of Narsil, and so that's how these items came to be in Rivendell in Imladris.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because Otar was able to make it safely.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. So Otar flees. That's how the shards of Narsil come to be in Imladris. And then we have the first wave of orcs coming and attacking, right? So the good news is the first wave of orcs does very little damage. And they're able to fend them off. And Isildur, after fending them off, decides that it's time for them to resume the march north, and hoping that they gave such a punishing to the orcs that they will leave them be. But of course, as we might expect, that's not going to happen.
Nope.
So,
orcs are going to orc.
Mm-hmm. Now, I found this next paragraph very interesting. All right. So, it says, but he was mistaken.
About?
It says, but he was mistaken.
But what was he mistaken about?
Well, why don't you let me read?
Oh.
I'm reading the thing, so I'm just saying. But he was mistaken, but, okay, I'll tell you. He was mistaken about the orcs leaving, right? The orcs basically not coming back, right?
Okay.
So that was the manner of orcs who were most often dismayed when their prey could turn and bite, but he was mistaken. There was not only cunning in the attack, but fierce and relentless hatred. The orcs of the mountains were stiffened and commanded by grim servants of Barad-dûr, sent out long before to watch the passes. And though it was unknown to them, the ring, cut from his black hand 2 years before, was still laden with Sauron's evil will and called to all his servants for their aid. The Dúnedain had gone scarcely a mile when the orcs moved again. This time they did not charge, but used all their forces. They came down on a wide front, which bent into a crescent and soon closed into an unbroken ring about the Dúnedain. They were silent now and kept at a distance out of the range of the dreaded steel bows of Numenor, though the light was fast failing and Isildur had all too few archers for his need. He halted. Now, what do you think I found interesting about that last paragraph?
About the grim servants of Barad-dûr.
Well, yes, that it calls to them, but that's actually not what I was thinking. I'll tell you.
Okay.
I'm not meaning to toy with you. I just wanted to see if you could guess.
John, I just want you to stop mansplaining. Okay?
Well, I know.
Stop being mean to me.
I'm bad about that. I'll stop mansplaining when you stop woman-splaining.
You know what?
Hey, this is Tolksplaining, okay?
Tolksplaining.
This is Tolksplaining.
Well, you're asking me to read your mind is what you're asking me to do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No, I just wanted to see if you could guess. I just wanted to see if it would be the same thing you'd guess. Anyway,
I didn't find anything interesting.
Oh, okay. You just
to be completely honest.
All right.
Yeah, I skimmed it.
You were like, started falling asleep.
I was like, can I go read my other book now, please?
Oh, man. Don't make me fire you.
Oops.
Yeah.
I better stop.
All right.
Tell me, what did you find interesting, John?
So the thing that I found interesting was that they form, that the orcs basically, instead of coming at them like they did before, right, just full-on assault, they form a crescent around them and eventually meet up. And what does it form? It forms a ring, right?
Oh.
So it forms a ring around them, around the Numenoreans.
Like the ring.
Right.
The one ring.
Exactly.
Oh, I didn't pick up on that.
Yeah. So
that is interesting.
You know, it doesn't. I mean, it doesn't like textually. It doesn't give it. Seem to give it like, you know, a ton of like. It doesn't make it all woo woo necessarily.
No. Mm-mm.
But I just thought that was really interesting that the first time they tried to attack, the orcs just like kind of did what we probably think of orcs doing, which is like, let's go get them raw. And then they get beat because they're not well organized and they attack foolishly and the Numenoreans are good at defense. But when they step back, they reorder themselves and then they come with this, you know, organized ring, which almost like strangles the Numenoreans, right? Mm-hmm. So I just thought that was really interesting that the what ends up being successful against the Numenoreans is that they form this ring around them,
yeah.
right? Especially yeah. in that paragraph where we hear some, you know, things about the will of the ring, right? That it's still doing Sauron's bidding. All right. So the orcs slowly close in as if hoping to strangle the Dúnedain, and Elendur asks his father about using the One Ring. So he says, Atarinya, what of the power that would cow these foul creatures and command them to obey you? Is it then of no avail? And Isildur says, alas, it is not, Senya. I cannot use it. I dread the pain of touching it, and I have not yet found the strength to bend it to my will. It needs one greater than I now know myself to be. My pride has fallen. It should go to the Keepers of the Three. And the Keepers of the Three is, of course, a reference to the Keeper of the Three Elven Rings. So Galadriel, mm-hmm. Círdan, and Elrond. Thank you.
Mm, that's yep. what I was going to say. Yeah. Mm. So he realizes,
mm-hmm.
he realizes the power of the ring, but a little too late, I'm mm-hmm. afraid. Yeah.
He does. Well, I feel like he had a good sense of it even before, you know, I mean, I feel like he had had it for a few years now. Right. So you think he would be kind of knowledgeable of the power it might
right.
have. I mean, not all of the power it might have over him, but he knew how important this ring was to Sauron, right? Everybody knew the power of this ring.
Right, but I mean, he didn't willing, like, at least at this point, he says it should go to the Keepers of the Three. Like, he yeah. recognizes that he himself is not qualified
mm-hmm.
to keep it. But if he had realized that sooner, this all would have been avoided.
Yep.
That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
It is a good, point. A good point. You're right. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So when night comes, the orcs fling themselves upon the Dúnedain with reckless abandon. They pay up to 5-1 in the exchange, so 5 orcs for every Dúnedain. But at the end of the day, their numbers are so large that that's going to overcome the Dúnedain mm-hmm. regardless. Mm-hmm. So Círdan is slain. Aratan is mortally wounded. Of course, the two other of Elendil's or of Isildur's sons, other than Elendur, who are here, and so Círdan is slain and Aratan is mortally wounded, attempting to rescue Círdan. And then again, Elendur pleads with Isildur. He pleads with Isildur about the use of the ring. Do you want to read these next few paragraphs, beginning with Elendur not yet harmed?
Elendur not yet harmed sought Isildur. He was rallying the men on the east side where the assault was heaviest, for the orcs still feared the Elendilmir. And Elendilmir that he bore on his brow and avoided him. Elendur touched him on the shoulder and he turned fiercely, thinking an orc had crept behind him. My king, said Elendur, Círdan is dead and Aratan is dying. Your last counselor must advise, nay command you, as you commanded Otar. Go, take your burden, and at all costs bring it to the Keepers, even at the cost of abandoning your men and me. King's son, said Isildur, I knew that I must do so, but I feared the pain, nor could I go without your leave. Forgive me, and my pride has brought you to this doom. Elendur kissed him. Go, go now, he said. Isildur turned west, and drawing up the ring that hung in a wallet from a fine chain about his neck, he set it upon his finger with a cry of pain, and was never seen again by any eye upon Middle-earth. But the Elendilmir of the west could not be quenched, and suddenly it blazed forth red and wrathful as a burning star. Men and orcs gave way in fear, and Isildur, drawing a hood over his head, vanished into the night.
Yeah, so this Elendilmir is the Star of Elendil, or the Star of the North Kingdom, a jewel made of mithril. It became a token of royalty throughout the Kingdom of Arnor, having been first crafted and presented to the High King of Gondor and Arnor, Elendil the Tall, in the Second Age. Elendilmir was a radiant white gemstone set on a silver fillet and was regarded as Arnor's royal gem.
So he's wearing that at the... Isildur is wearing it.
Yes,
he has it on his person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is the same... It's actually the same thing that will... You know what? There's a lot in the notes of this chapter. We're going to save that for the next episode. But some really interesting notes. I did kind of wonder if this was the Star of the Dúnedain, right? That is referred to, that we talked about when we talked about the Fourth Age, right? And Sam receiving the Star of the Dúnedain.
Yes.
So, and I think we actually found our answer, at least the most definitive answer we're probably going to find in the notes to this chapter. So you'll have to wait till next week, or you can go ahead and read and see if you can find what I'm talking about. But you can read ahead, but we'll talk about that next week. Good bit of discussion on the Elendilmir to talk about.
Cool.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. So, but yeah, we see Isildur fleeing. Okay, at this point, he's, you know, basically Elendor is like, you know, pretty much, you need to get out of here, all right? So he Isildur flees with the One Ring, and the Elendilmir of the West suddenly blazes forth, even as he puts it on, right? So he puts on the ring, you assume he's going to become invisible, but apparently the Elendilmir still shines forth, right? Which is really interesting. Thing to note.
So everything but the Elendilmir was invisible?
Apparently so.
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right. So only one Dúnedain survives and Elendor does not. We do hear some really nice things said of Elendor. Of what befell the Dúnedain, only this was later known. Ere long, they all lay dead, save one, a young esquire, stunned and buried under fallen men. So perished Elendor, who should afterwards have been king, and as all foretold who knew him, in his strength and wisdom and his majesty without pride, one of the greatest, the fairest of the seed of Elendil, most like to his grandsire. So Isildur, of course, we hear of his pride at the beginning of this chapter. And one thing that marks his son Elendor is that he has maybe the same or greater wisdom than his father, but he doesn't have the pride. So, which of course just only will serve to amplify his wisdom, right?
Right.
You know, his ability to make wise, detached decisions to the benefit of all.
So he would have made a really good king.
He would have, which, you know, amplifies the tragedy of the, of this, right? Amplifies the disaster of it all.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows what may have been different, right?
Yeah.
Who knows what may have been different in the whole history of the Third Age if Isildur had just destroyed the One Ring. Yeah.
Well, we would have had a lot less to talk about on our podcast.
This is true.
That's for sure.
Yeah, this is true. And we most likely would not even have the book, The Lord of the Rings.
Exactly.
So.
Exactly. Or even The Hobbit.
Yeah, we wouldn't. Yeah.
No.
So.
Crazy.
Well, so I guess in a weird way, we're very thankful to Isildur for being such a selfish jerk.
He's preserved our...
Being such a...
our hobby.
Prideful a-hole. So...
Well, see, good can come of even the most darkest moments.
Yes.
Maybe it's our own little you catastrophe.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Isildur.
The happy fault.
The happy fault.
Yes.
So.
All right. Well, we've got a little bit about Isildur's fate here. Do you want to read the next two now of Isildur?
Now of Isildur, it is told...
I got to stop you. It's Isildur.
I like the way I'm saying it better.
We got told that you're supposed to put the emphasis on the second syllable for these Numenorean names.
Isildur?
Isildur.
Isildur.
Yeah.
Okay. Now of Isildur, it is told that he was in great pain and anguish of heart, but at first he ran like a stag from the hounds until he came to the bottom of the valley. There he halted to make sure that he was not pursued, for orcs could track a fugitive in the dark by scent and needed no eyes. Then he went on more warily, for wide flat stretched on into the gloom before him, rough and pathless, with many traps of wandering feet. So it was that he came at last to the banks of the Anduin at the dead of night, and he was weary, for he had made a journey that the Dúnedain on such ground could have made no quicker, marching without halt and by day. The river was swirling dark and swift before him. He stood for a while, alone and in despair. Then in haste he cast off all his armor and weapons, save a short sword at his belt, and plunged into the water. He was a man of strength and endurance that few even of the Dunedain of that age could equal, but he had little hope to gain the other shore. Before he had gone far, he was forced to turn almost north against the current, and strive as he might, he was ever swept down towards the tangles of the gladdened fields. They were nearer than he had thought, and even as he felt the stream slacken and had almost won across, he found himself struggling among great rushes and clinging weeds. There suddenly he knew that the ring had gone. By chance, or chance well used, it had left his hand and gone where he could never hope to find it again. At first, so overwhelming was his sense of loss that he struggled no more, and would have sunk and drowned. But swift as it had come, the mood passed. The pain had left him. A great burden had been taken away. His feet found the river bed, and heaving himself up out of the mud, he floundered through the reeds to a marshy islet close to the western shore. There he rose up out of the water, only a mortal man, a small creature lost and abandoned in the wilds of Middle-earth. But to the night-eyed orcs that lurked there on the watch, he loomed up, a monstrous shadow of fear, with a piercing eye like a star. They loosed their poisoned arrows at it and fled. Needlessly, for Isildur, unarmed, was pierced through heart and throat, and without a cry he fell back into the water. No trace of his body was ever found by elves or men. So passed the first victim of the malice of the Masterless Ring, Isildur, second king of all the Dunedain, lord of Arnor and Gondor, and in that age of the world the last.
Yeah. So
too bad he almost escaped.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like the star sold him out.
I don't think it deliberately did.
Well, not deliberately, but I'm saying that's why they were able to find him.
Oh, totally, yeah. Well, I mean, it was the, you know, it is an interesting detail, I guess. You know, you could say that's an interesting detail.
Mm-hmm. It seems like it should have the opposite effect. It should be a sign of, it should be a protective jewel, right? It should serve to protect. But in this case, it was the reason they were able to see him.
I think it does in a way, right? Because when he first escapes from the battle, it like blazes out and it scares everybody away so that they leave him alone. But then in this case, it basically, when he's trying to hide from everybody, it gives him away because it's so bright that the orcs see it and they think he's some kind of crazy one-eyed monster with a shining bright eye. And so they shoot their arrows and run, right?
But he wouldn't have been invisible at this point because the ring had fallen off.
Right, but it's nighttime, so, you know, and it's so bright, like, you know, when you see, like, a flashlight at night, you don't initially see the person who's carrying the flashlight, you just see the flashlight, right?
No, that's true. Yeah.
So that is the fate of Isildur, right? So the ring leaves him in the gladden fields, and then he meets his death at the hands of these orcs.
But they never find his body.
Yeah, but we'll get to that in the next episode, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to talk about that.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. There's a lot of interesting detail in this story.
Yeah.
I mean, we'll talk a lot more about the Elendilmir. We'll talk more about what happened to Isildur's body. Just all kinds of interesting detail to discuss here. to discuss here, so...
Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess I'll just have to be patient.
Yeah.
Okay.
I want to save a lot of good stuff for the next episode.
Yeah. So. I mean, we want people to keep listening.
Yeah.
We give them reason to keep coming back. So makes sense.
Our awesome personalities are reason enough.
Yeah, that's true.
At this point, let's face it. We could just, you know, we just be like, hey, what's up? We're John and Greta. We're just going to talk about whatever.
Whatever.
And, you know, I'm sure people would listen then.
Probably.
Probably not.
No. I guess it depends what we talked about. Well, anyway.
Yeah.
Well, I'm already looking forward to the next episode then.
Yeah.
It'll be good.
We are going to talk about interesting stuff on the next episode.
I know we are. I'm looking forward to it.
Absolutely.
Okay.
All right. So that is the story of the disaster of the Gladden Fields, how that tragic moment in the history of Middle-earth came to pass. But there's more. On the next episode, we will be going deeper into the details of the account, as well as examining what happened when Aragorn discovered some of Isildur's lost artifacts in Orthanc at the end of the Third Age.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, ma'am.
Good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
All right, correspondence time.
Correspondence.
Yeah, we got a good bit of correspondence to go through this week. We'll start off with an iTunes comment, which was me likey. Yeah. So this is from Robert H. or Robert HH, I guess I could say. 5 stars, great Tolkien tribute. Really enjoy the insight and the knowledge. Fun to read along with them. This show is great.
Oh, cool.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank you so much, Robert. We appreciate those kind words.
Very much.
We appreciate that you said them to the entire world like that and helped us out on the, you know, on the search rankings for iTunes.
For sure. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Very much appreciate that.
All right. Our next note is from David R., and this is from October 8th. David left a comment on episode 195, The Future of Middle-Earth 2020 edition. David said, regarding opera, I recommend The Ring, Der Ring des Nibelungen by Wagner. The scale and scope of the story is epic. It follows the struggles of gods, heroes, and several mythical creatures, dwarves, giants, etc., over the eponymous magic ring that grants domination over the entire world. The drama and intrigue continue through 3 generations of protagonists until the final cataclysm at the end. I've always felt it was an obvious choice for Tolkien fans. Interesting.
I can see why.
You know, I've heard that I've heard that connection made in the past, and for me, like, opera is just not something that I've done a lot of, you know,
listening to,
right? Mm-hmm. I know many people who have a lot of respect for, appreciate it a lot. So, you know, maybe one of these days, maybe it's that opera that I just need to listen to, right?
Maybe.
Now, I know some of it because of, I believe that some of it is from, is used in the famous Bugs Bunny cartoon where he's like, it's him and I think it's Daffy Duck. And they basically do like this whole opera thing back and forth. And it's really funny. It's really clever. But I think they actually have selections from The Ring by Wagner. So
who would have thought?
It may be something else by Wagner, but I'm almost certain it's Wagner. So, well, thank you for that recommendation.
Yes.
David.
Thank you very much.
We will, I will keep that noted. I may just go ahead and throw the opera itself into iTunes so I can just sit down and listen to it one day here.
Yeah, not a bad idea.
Yeah, every once in a while I get on kind of a classical music kick, and I listen to classical music for a couple of weeks without listening to anything else. Probably my brain needs it needs to listen to this really good, high quality stuff.
Yeah.
So.
I agree.
Yeah.
I think we all could listen to more high quality stuff.
Yeah, like, you know, sure. Classical, you know, not to say other music isn't high quality, but like classical music, there's...
Just something very relaxing and... Like, or refreshing about
not always
it.
Relaxing sometimes it's not relaxing but well, it's just beautiful, you know, it's just beautiful in a different way, you know, it engages your brain in a different
that
way.
That is true. So. Yep.
All right, our next note is from Joey S. Let's see here, gotta find it in my queue of all these messages here. Where is it?
Popular, bear with us people.
Oh, just scrolling through pages and pages and pages. Yes.
Well, you really should be more organized.
I know. I try. Yep. Here we go. Joey S. said, absolutely no reason for that stuff in this show. Referring to all the stuff we've talked about with Electronic Prime.
I thought he was talking about me and like all my random comments.
Oh, man.
I was like, wait a second, Joey. I thought we were friends.
He's right back at me like, no, I meant you. I meant both of you. No, Joey's good people. Joey is good people. He said absolutely no reason for that stuff in this show. I hope it's only a rumor. We do too. Yes. At the end of the day, Tolkien never included this stuff because it was not what he wanted. They need to pay attention to that and realize true fans will not watch this show. We don't look forward to nudity or sex in his realm. It's not necessary, and it actually would take away from the power of the story that is Numenor in the Second Age. This ticked me off when I heard this stuff. If I wanted to watch Game of Thrones, then I would. We want Middle Earth, not a perverted and twisted view of Tolkien's works.
Boom.
Boom.
Yep.
I mean, that's it right there.
Can I get an amen?
Amen.
Amen, Joey.
Amen, Joey.
Preach it.
I mean, look, everybody understands Game of Thrones was really popular, and it's got its fans out there, but at the end of the day, you're making a huge mistake if you try and make a Middle Earth show like mimic what Game of Thrones was. Middle Earth should be Middle Earth. It doesn't need to mimic anything else.
Nope.
And if you think it does,
it can stand on its own for sure.
If you think it does, you're just wrong. You're wrong, and you're unworthy of writing for it, of creating something
mm-hmm.
in it.
Mm-hmm.
So
agreed.
Let's see here. So what's next? Thanks, Joey.
Yes.
Sorry.
Yes. Thank you, Joey. Phew.
I thought we were on for another soapbox. No. Well, I can go if you want.
I know you can, but I'm good.
Next note is from Namdar on October 20th. He says, sorry, I'm not sure actually if it's a male or a female who's writing this. I'm not sure with the name Namdar. It's not a name I'm familiar with. So my apologies ahead of time, but I'll go ahead and read your note. I really enjoy your show, especially your most recent episode on the Lord of the Rings Amazon Prime series. As a dedicated Tolkien reader, I've read The Silmarillion twice and only grasped half of the book. Truth be told, the stories about the creation of the world and the early challenges of the Valar distract me from the rest of the masterpiece. In regards to the Valar, I observe a lot of characteristics they share with Zoroastrianism's Amesha Spenta. Both are groups of immortal angelic beings with defined genders, elemental powers, and specific duties. Just as the Amesha Spenta represent the various divine attributes of Ahura Mazda, the Valar are the manifestations of Iluvatar's luminous spirit. When considering the comparison, one begins to wonder if Professor Tolkien had knowledge of the Amesha Spenta. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on the matter. That's a great question, Namdar. So this is the first I've heard of that. I'm familiar with Zoroastrianism on a very vague, high level, just that of its existence, basically. And I've always understood it as a, it was always explained to me as like a monotheistic religion. But maybe it is a monotheistic religion in the same way that Tolkien's universe is truly monotheistic in the sense that there is only one God, right? Mm-hmm. God, right? The ultimate being. And then all of the other powerful beings, right, are not gods in the same way that he is, right? They're created beings, right? So maybe that's how this works with Zoroastrianism. It maybe sounds like that. But Namdar, the question you're asking is a really interesting one, and one that I am personally incapable of answering, but I'm throwing it out there in case anybody else who's listening has knowledge of such things and can speak to whether Tolkien maybe borrowed ideas from Zoroastrianism with his own mythology. So,
yeah. So if you know, hit us up.
It's an interesting question to be sure.
It really is. So, for sure, yeah.
We've of course talked plenty on this show about the influence of Christianity on Tolkien's works and on his universe, but it's always been kind of a sticky point with a lot of Christians, honestly, with the idea that there's like Iluvatar, but then there's all these other powerful gods, right? And Christianity tends to be a monotheistic religion. So people are like, well, why does he have all these other gods in there? And for me, it's one of the most interesting aspects of his works and something I'd like to explore eventually, how that aligns in his mind, because I think it was something that C.S. Lewis actually maybe had a similar idea of, right? That there were, that Christianity has its God, the ultimate being, right? The one who is eternal, whom is the ground of all being. And then you have all these created gods, right? Created powerful beings, but they are nonetheless finite beings, mm-hmm. right? They're nonetheless finite creatures.
Mm-hmm.
So, is that possible? I think Tolkien and Lewis might've held that that's possible within the within a Christian understanding of the cosmos, right? I think there's an argument made that angels are that very thing, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Anyway, it would be a very interesting topic to do. So Namdar, thank you for the question. I'm sorry I'm not better equipped to answer it in a very knowledgeable way, but maybe some of our listeners out there who are knowledgeable of such things can weigh in an educated fashion.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Stay in touch, Namdar.
Yes, thanks for the note.
Yes, thank you very much. All right, our next note is from Jonathan R. It's been a while since we heard from Jonathan, so he is sending us a note saying it's been a while, right? He says, howdy, Tolkien Teamsters. Sorry to drop off the face of the earth for a while. I had to put down The Hobbit and wasn't going to listen until I was able to read each chapter. I recently took a few days and finished off the book, which is not a first edition in the sense I was hoping for, but was a first edition of the illustrated version. Still very good, but not what I expected. Anyway, I finished off the second half of the book before a long work trip requiring me to drive a lot, which allowed me to binge several episodes. While I am still not caught up to your current episodes, I am almost finished with your episodes on The Hobbit. I wanted to drop you a line as you had mentioned me in a few episodes. Thanks for that. Still can't believe it when I hear you say my name. I'm glad you enjoyed that tidbit I sent about the Smaug genus. Yeah, I remember that. Several episodes ago for us now, but the Smaug genus of bird, I believe.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes, yes, yes.
Right. In your episode on The Gathering of the Clouds, episode 163, you brought up the birds and subsequently me. Greta was right. I did enjoy all those birds. I loved that the thrush could speak to the men of Dale and the ravens could speak to dwarves. So just to refresh you, Greta, because I know it's been a while since we heard from Jonathan, I believe he's an ornithologist.
Yes, right? It's coming back.
Yeah,
to me.
He is a professional bird guy.
Mm-hmm.
As he says later in his email, he says he's a bird nerd. So he's a professional bird nerd.
I like
right?
that. Yeah. Good deal.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So. I love that the thrush could speak to the men of Dale and the ravens could speak to dwarves. There's probably a lot to unpack right there, but I won't get too bogged down. You also joked about having me on the show to discuss birds and Tolkien. While I obviously would love to be on the show for fan-related reasons, I would also add that birds play a very large role in Tolkien's lore and legendarium, which I think would be an interesting topic to discuss. Also, I will note that of the few specific kinds of birds that play the biggest parts in Tolkien's writing, those being eagles, thrush, raven, vultures, even the Bam and Brown owls, the dwarves tell Bilbo to hoot like before he approaches Tom, Bert, and William, the trolls, those are all forest birds. The only other bird that falls outside that are the gulls that call the elves to the west. Those may be up there in importance with the eagles, given their relation to the elves, Ulmo, and Iluvatar. Other than that, there are no waterfowl, game birds, or others really mentioned. The reason I stress the forest birds is because of Tolkien's great esteem for trees. These are all birds that have remarkably close relations to trees. The thrush in The Hobbit is described like our Swainsons, hermit, gray cheat, or wood thrush. Those are all deep forest birds that you can hear from very far and sound as if they are coming from the depths of the woods. Their songs are beautiful and ethereal. Hermit thrushes are very fluty, almost having an elvish sound to them. I digress. These are not birds found on common lawn or park. These are birds that prefer the forest floors beneath great, tall, deep patches of trees. The only breeding population of Swainson's thrush in Pennsylvania is found in the Allegheny National Forest. Within that forest is one of the oldest growth strands of trees left in Pennsylvania. Unsurprising that these birds should choose such a special place. I've been to these places, and they are truly magical in a sense I believe Tolkien would understand. I walk through those woods and imagine Ents shepherding the oaks and hickory and the spruce and walnut. Tolkien loved trees, and I love birds. The two are intertwined in so many ways. I like to think Tolkien enjoyed the birds inhabiting his favorite trees. Boom. Man, dropping some amazing bird knowledge on us here. This is really good stuff. So they're all forest birds, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of the birds, except for the gulls, right?
Mm-hmm.
Needless to say, I could go on and on down rabbit hole after rabbit hole. How did Tolkien put it? I don't have the gift of brevity. Something along those lines. Get me started on birds, toss in some Tolkien lore, and best put on another pot of tea because I could go on for hours. That's awesome.
That's so good.
Jonathan, I just have to say, I am happy for you that you found your career
mm-hmm.
in the thing that you seem to love the most.
Absolutely.
That's really cool.
It's a great gift.
Absolutely. Your knowledge of birds here is just is remarkable mm-hmm. and very interesting. P.S. I wanted to make a note about black squirrels, as this is a topic that continues to pop up around Tolkien's writing. I am not familiar with the European variant, but in the U.S., black squirrels are simply a pigment variant of fox squirrels. Unlike their fox red brethren, black squirrels are simply all black. Oh, I think you meant unlike their fox red brethren, squirrels are simply all black.
Mm-hmm.
Similar to an albino lacking all pigment, these black squirrels have all of it. Just a simple genetic mutation passed down through the population. They aren't a subspecies or anything. It's like in a family of brunettes and one turns out blonde.
Hmm.
PPS, I hope you are both well and the show is going strong. I see new Patreon emails about new episodes all the time, it seems. Keep up the great work, and I hope to catch up to current episodes very soon. All the best, your bird nerd pal, John.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So good. Thanks, Jonathan.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. It's great hearing from you. Mm-hmm. And thanks for dropping all that incredible Tolkienian bird knowledge mm-hmm. on us.
Right? It would be a fun episode to just focus on the birds.
Absolutely. I mean, it just never fails with Tolkien, right? Yeah,
there's always more to talk about.
Like, if I was going to write a story, I'd be like, oh, let's throw in some birds over here and, like, for effect and everything like that. And Tolkien's like, no, it's just so real. It's just so organic.
And they each have so much significance. Like, he doesn't just randomly pick birds. Like, he chooses them for reasons.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's just,
so well thought out.
For all of the thoughtfulness, for all of how much we probably wish that we had more stories, from that he wrote, just the time that he had to spend on these stories and fleshing out the mythology just for himself, for his own satisfaction. It's truly a remarkable thing.
It's
something I'm very thankful for, and it makes it truly special.
It really does. It really, really does.
And our final notes are from Jennifer. We have a couple of notes from a longtime listener, Jennifer, and she starts off by responding to our episode 212, which is the one where we shared the news of the Latron Prime scandals first, if you will. And she wrote in response to that comment, she said, she left a comment and said, is Doctor Who would say, what? Please, no Game of Thrones stuff in Tolkien. That is the kind of thing we don't need to see.
Absolutely. Yeah,
that's it.
Yep.
Right there.
That sums it up.
And then she wrote in response to the recent episode, she said, hello, John and Greta. An inspiring idea came to me this morning concerning the Amazon Prime series. Get as many people as you can to pray. Pray for the people at Amazon that they will make the right choices. Pray for the writers and directors. Pray that Amazon will produce a Middle Earth series that will be upright and objectively moral and will include the Christian elements, themes, and symbolism. Pray that the people involved with this production will listen to the Tolkien fans and to the Tolkien estate and family. God bless you both and your family, Jennifer. Thank you so much, mm-hmm. Jennifer. And if you are like Greta and I, and you pray and you believe in the power of prayer, I think that's a very worthy cause, right? Because this is an important show, right? It's truly an important show because as people who create, a Tolkien podcast and do a Tolkien podcast, and like so many of you, we believe that Tolkien's works are truly special, mm-hmm. right? They're on a plane unlike any other stories,
right.
That we have. And so they deserve a treatment that Tolkien would be proud of, would be happy with. And I think that's what I want most for these stories, is that Tolkien himself, to believe that if Tolkien himself were around, then he would approve of how these stories are done.
And that he would watch the series.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, yeah, we will definitely be doing that, Jennifer. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that reminder to pray and not to be if things don't be seeming to go right, not to be spiteful or vengeful minded or anything like that about it, but just to pray that the people would the people who are in charge of the show would see it not as a not as it's just like, well, let's just churn out another Hollywood production, but as something that they're handling that's truly a sacred work of art, mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
And it needs to be handled with care and with attention and like a true work of art.
Mm-hmm.
So,
word.
Great note.
Indeed.
All right. Well, that's some great correspondence for this week.
Yeah, really, really good.
We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear from you if you've written before. If you haven't written before, just send us correspondence at TolkienRoadPodcast@gmail.com, through TolkienRoad.com, Facebook, Twitter, whatever it is, and we will respond to you in due time. So,
yeah. Yes. I love how vague that is. In due time.
Sometimes it takes a little longer than others. So,
I know. It's just funny.
We do our best. All right, y'all. Well, we appreciate everybody listening. We want to give a shout out. Oh, on our next episode, we'll continue with the disaster of the Gladden Fields and look at everything else in that chapter.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be good.
And it'll be good.
Yeah, it will be. It'll be real good.
All right. Well, hey, special thanks to our patrons, especially the following: Shannon S.
Brian O.
Emilio P.
Zeke F.
James A.
James L.
Chris L.
Chuck F.
Azia V.
Ish of the Hammer.
Teresa C.
David of Pints with Jack.
Jonathan D.
Eric S.
Joey S.
Eric B.
Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien.
Matt L.
Johanna T.
Todd G.
Ms. Anonymous.
And Sam N.
Thank you all so
much. Thank you, guys.
Absolutely. And we will talk at you next time.
Yes, we will. Bye, y'all.
Bye-bye.